Well, good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and it's wonderful to have a great crowd here on a Tuesday evening after we had the arrival of Old Man Winter a few days ago. We can still tonight think about gardens and green things, and I'm glad that you were able to come out and join us for both a talk by Elizabeth Barlow Rogers and, of course, our book launch of our new publication that the library is proud to be working with in sponsorship with the Foundation for Landscape Studies and the publisher David R. Godin. If I may ask any of you who have cell phones, pagers, anything that might ring during the next 45 minutes, it would be great if you could take it out and turn it off. We do record these events, so both for the benefit of members and guests here tonight and future people watching this on the internet, they won't hear your phones going off. This is the time of year that the Society Library does ask its members for annual support. The support of each of you is critical to the success of the library. From everything from our growing children's library to our great book collection, including books on landscape design and gardening, to just everything we do here in the library. I want to thank all of you who have contributed so far and urge the rest of you to consider us this fall. The library's major underwriter for this project must be thanked with a round of applause. And though she cannot be with us tonight, we would certainly like to thank Deborah S. Pease, who was the major underwriter of the book and exhibition and made a very kind donation to the library. So thanks to Deborah S. Pease for her support. The Society Library, for the first time, has done a co-publication with the Foundation for Landscape Studies, and we're very pleased to be working with the Foundation. And we're also very pleased to be working with one of the true masters of book publishing in the United States and perhaps in the world, David R. Godin. And I believe David was not able to be here tonight, but he sends his regrets, and we're very proud to be working with him. It's my pleasure to now step away from the microphone and introduce you to Paula Dietz, who is the author of many fine books, including this very recent book, Of Gardens, Selected Essays, which is in our library collection and you can borrow. Paula is known, for one, as being the editor of the literary magazine The Hudson Review, but she's also a very fine writer and cultural critic in the area of landscape design, art, architecture, and design. So please welcome Paula Dietz.
Well, we're here this evening really to celebrate two important occasions, the launch of this special book, Writing in the Garden, and the libraries that inspired it, both the New York Society Library and Betsy Barlow Rogers' own collection of garden books that have been lovingly selected over the years. And since you have heard about the genesis of this of the book from the exhibition, I should like to add a brief word of my own in appreciation of how much the Society Library has added to my own writing career, and I always tell people that I consider the fountain of information I discovered in its open stacks to be my secret weapon, you know. I first met Betsy through her writing about Frederick Law Olmsted for the Whitney Museum's 1972 exhibition of his work, where I learned that except for a time studying abroad, my whole life had been lived in Olmsted landscapes, Cadwalader Park in Trenton, New Jersey, the campus of Smith College in Central Park. But it has become clear to me in all the years since that while Olmsted was the luminary of the 19th century, that we in the garden world here live in the inspiring aura and era of Betsy Barlow Rogers. I remembered attending performances of the New York City Ballet and seeing Balanchine standing just behind the curtain in the wings and thinking how extraordinary it was to live in the time of his creations. And that is exactly how I feel about the way that Betsy's inspired accomplishments have given us a way of life and a perspective on the world of landscapes and gardens. In a most important way, both through her work in Central Park and now with the Foundation for Landscape Studies, she has created for us a community, which is one of the most crucial elements of contemporary life. And this community of gardeners and garden writers thrives with the pleasure of each other's company, and you can just tell by looking around this room. In her introductory words, Betsy has written that half of gardening is reading, and in this book she pays tribute to these dual interests by gathering a group of garden writers who she feels make a well-rounded community over a long period of time. It is an illuminating and very handsome book, and I salute its author, who for me, as for so many others, has been an inspiration as a mentor, teacher, and friend. Betsy.
You know how you feel after an introduction like that? Oh, if only my mother were here. It's really wonderful to be here in this wonderful place. I was upstairs just yesterday writing some remarks in the beautiful renovated room for scholars. And there are so many things that you're doing here these days, Mark, that make this just an even more remarkable place than it has been all these years since 1753. 54, I'm sorry. Okay. I have to say also, thanks, Mark, but thank you, Harriet. Harriet Shapiro is the head of exhibitions, and we are also grateful to the library's exhibition committee chair, Jeanette Watson Sanger, who couldn't be with us tonight. It was her idea to do this exhibition, and that, in turn, provided the occasion for writing this book. And I also want to say how grateful I am to all the other members of the library staff who worked to bring it to fruition, my collaborator Harriet, of course, as well as Mark, and Brandy Tambasco, who helped us get clean as a whistle copy through numerous collective proofreadings, right? Those gremlins, they just kept showing up in the proofs and drove us crazy. Anyway, gardening is an art form, and just as there are garden writers, there are garden artists. My book is dedicated to three of them, Frank Cabot, Jack Lenore Larson, and Henriette Soar. Jack could not be with us tonight, but Henriette is here, and I think maybe if she'd stand up and turn around, you could see this remarkable lady who has created one of the great, great gardens of America. It's up in Mount Kisco. It's called Rocky Hills. And it will become part of the Westchester County Park Department someday. To begin, let's get down on our hands and knees. True gardeners always start in the most literal sense from the ground up. For them, digging in the dirt is much more than a metaphor. Soil is the fundamental medium of their art, and their close attention to its quality is a leitmotif that runs throughout our present survey. For them, nothing is sweeter than the smell of freshly turned soil. More than any herbal fragrance, this is the most intoxicating garden aroma of all. But let's not romanticize too much. Knowing the kind of soil that is right for your garden is an elementary part of horticultural science. It is not surprising, therefore, to hear our garden writers carry on about its hardness, its friability, its acidity, its tilth. Here's another basic fact. The Garden of Eden may have been the only garden not to have had aphids, scale insects, moth larvae, mealybugs, spider mites, cabbage worms, and a host of other unwelcome guests, including the slug, a slimy, shellless mollusk. This nocturnal predator can ravage foliage and kill plants faster than they can grow. The slug is a universal scourge, the bane of gardeners everywhere, and a subject discussed with unqualified repugnance and unbridled ire by several of the authors we encounter in these pages. As I began to browse the books in the stacks of the library and on my own shelves at home, I started to notice that there are several different species of garden writers. In one category, we have women such as Jane Loudon and Gertrude Jekyll, female gardeners in what was still in their day an all-male occupation. Then there are those I like to call garden warriors, in the front rank of which stand William Robinson and Reginald Blomfield. isn't it wonderful how people in landscape and gardening, they have words like field and bush and in their names, their very names, green tree. William Robinson and Reginald Blomfield, who took violent issue with one another over the principles of garden design. There are also rhapsodists like Celia Thaxter, who never met a flower that didn't send them over the moon. We'll also find nurserymen who cultivate and write about plants and garden making, and the foragers who scour the Alps and the Himalayas for rock garden rarities to dig up or dig up plants in the wild closer to home. We are also going to meet such travelers as Edith Wharton and Paula Dietz, whose perspicacious descriptions of foreign gardens broaden the reader's knowledge of various garden styles. In addition, I've included humorists, writers who find the garden a fertile source of comedy. We have spouses, including Vita Sackville-West and Harold Nicholson, whose gardens are collaborative efforts. Vita also falls in the category of our correspondents, garden columnists and letter writers, whose words were later collected and published in books. You'll find conversationalists as well. These garden writers who sound like they're just talking to you over the back fence. Moreover, we have teachers such as Russell Page, Lyndon Miller, and Linda Yang in the back of the room. And finally, there are writers who use the garden as an arena of philosophical inquiry. And I'm thinking here of Thoreau and also of Michael Pollan and others, of course. One of my favorite garden writers is Celia Thaxter, whose beautiful book, An Island Garden with Illustrations by the artist Child Hassam, was published in 1895. It is one of the great first edition treasures here in the library, and it is right outside this door on display in our exhibition. And I have put Thaxter in the category of rhapsodist, as I mentioned. Here is how I describe her book. Although her profuse garden offered an abundance of painterly scenes, Thaxter does not speak about the art of garden design per se. Hers is a spiritual prose, as she writes of her own passionate responses to the ways in which plants perform and of the extremes to which she will go in nurturing them. A poppy seed is the merest atom of matter, hardly visible, a speck, a pin's point in bulk, but within it is imprisoned a spirit of beauty ineffable, which will break its bonds and emerge from the dark ground and blossom in a splendor so dazzling as to baffle all powers of description. The genie in the Arabian tale is not half so astonishing. She then sums up her possession of a green thumb in one word, love. for it is love that causes her to fill wooden boxes with well-rotted manure into which she nestles the cut eggshells with pricked bottoms that will serve as the containers in which her precious poppy seeds will germinate, after which she will gently place the delicate roots of the seedlings in the ground. Love, however, does not extend to Thaxter's garden enemies, the cutworm, the wireworm, the pansy worm, the thrip, the rose beetle, the aphis, the mildew, and many more, but the worst of all, the loathsome slug, a slimy, shapeless creature that devours every fair and exquisite thing in the garden. To combat this despicable garden marauder, the flower lover must seek those with unflagging energy and, if possible, exterminate the whole. It takes considerable wiliness to wage war on these nocturnal raiders. Thaxter tells us how at sunset she heaps air-slaked lime in rings around her flower beds as a barrier to the slug. Night patrol is also needed to conquer this determined pest, and she confesses how on many a solemn midnight have I stolen from my bed to visit my cherished treasures by the pale glimpse of the moon, that I might be quite sure that the protecting rings were still strong enough to save them. She also combats the slimy terrestrial mollusk with salt. However, afraid that salt like lime may prove injurious to her tender plants, she removes both in the morning when the slug has gone back into hiding beneath the ground. As an extra precaution to make sure they escaped injury as the ocean air and dew might dissolve these toxic substances into the soil, she collars her most beloved pets with rings of cut pasteboard and places her lime and salt on these. I'm going on and on with her. She's really wonderful. Thaxter suddenly becomes excited by advice from a friend on the mainland who, anticipating the advocates of biological pest control, tells her that toads like to dine on slugs. She immediately responds, "In the name of the prophet, toads!" and soon receives by mailboat, a box with 60 of them. They grow fat and multiply, and the next summer she imports 90 more. But toads, too, have their enemies, dogs and rats. And so the ranks of these garden warriors diminish. Nevertheless, Thaxter manages to keep a sufficient number at work in the garden, destroying slugs and insects, and therefore feels compelled to suggest that every gardener should treat the toad with utmost hospitality, and should he wander away from the premises, to go as far as to exercise gentle force in bringing him back to the regions where his services may be of the greatest utility. Along with Celia Thaxter, I've placed Elizabeth von Arnim, the author of the immensely popular Elizabeth and Her German Garden, in the category of garden rhapsodists. Married to a Pomeranian count whom she refers to as the Man of Wrath, this aristocratic and free-spirited Englishwoman chronicles her efforts to become a gardener in the face of the mores of aristocratic society in provincial Germany and the duties imposed on her as the mistress of her husband's large estate. The garden is her haven. According to her, the garden is the place I go for refuge and shelter, not the house. In the house are duties and annoyances, servants to exhort and admonish, furniture and meals. But out there, blessings crowd around me at every step. It is there that I am sorry for the unkindness in me, for those selfish thoughts that are so much worse than they feel. It is there that all my sins and silliness are forgiven. There that I feel protected and at home, and every flower and weed is a friend and every tree a lover. When I have been vexed, I run out to them for comfort. And when I have been angry without just cause, it is there that I find absolution. Did ever a woman have so many friends? Now, let's meet a real man of wrath, the indomitable garden warrior William Robinson, a contemporary of Gertrude Jekyll. Together, they started the revolution that transformed English garden style, liberating the landscape from Victorian formalism by pioneering the groupings of plants into naturalistic compositions that constitute a seemingly artless form of garden art. Of course, as Rosemary Vere, Penelope Hobhouse, and Lyndon Miller, who also appear in these pages, will tell you, there is nothing that the knowledgeable garden maker hasn't considered beforehand, except perhaps the fortuitous appearance of an occasional unexpected plant whose discovery may come as a delightful surprise. Going beyond the herbaceous border, however, into the meadow and woodland allows you to more actively encourage this kind of serendipity, which is what Robinson did. In my excerpt from his book, The Wild Garden, he points out, "Hundreds of the finest flowers will thrive much better in rough places than ever they did in the old-fashioned border, look infinitely better than they ever did in formal beds, have no disagreeable effects resulting from decay, since when they pass out of bloom, they are unnoticed amidst the vegetation and not eyesores, as when in rigid, unrelieved tufts and borders enable us to grow many plants that have never yet obtained a place in our trim gardens and settle the question of the spring flower garden, since we may cease the dreadful practice of tearing up the flower beds and leaving them like new dug graves twice a year." As a final point in its favor, the wild garden can be seen as a kind of paradisical reunion of nature and bounty, for from almost every interesting region, the traveler may bring seeds or plants and establish near his home living souvenirs of the various countries he has visited. Well, the architect Reginald Blomfield did not think much of Robinson's approach, particularly after the latter hurled several sarcastic barbs at him following his publication of The Formal Garden in England in 1892. In the second edition, which is the one I have, of this popular book, Blomfield accuses Robinson of willful misinterpretation and ignorance of garden making as a form of art, saying, "Mr. Robinson neither gives us the definition nor shows us where the art is or what it consists of. The trees are beautiful and so are the flowers. But where is Mr. Robinson's art? What does it do for us or for the trees or the flowers? His skill as a tree planter or as a flower grower is no doubt great, but that does not make him an artist. And by no possible wrestling of the term can he be called so on this ground only." Blomfield goes on to proclaim, "The formal treatment of the gardens ought perhaps to be called the architectural treatment of gardens, for it consists in the extension of the principles of design which govern the house to the grounds which surround it." Some 19th as well as 20th and 21st century nurserymen have ventured beyond the bounds of simple catalog descriptions of plants into a personal form of literary expression. Andrew Jackson Downing, that prolific promulgator of taste, the favorite word that 18th and 19th century trendsetters used as the hallmark of gentility, stands in the front rank of such nurserymen. In an essay titled On Feminine Taste in Rural Affairs, Downing takes up the theme of women in the garden. "What is the reason American ladies don't love to work in their gardens?" he asks rhetorically. The answer is, They may love to potter a little. Three or four times in the spring, they take a fancy to examine the color of the soil a few inches below the surface. They sow some China asters and plant a few dahlias, and it's all over. Love flowers with all their hearts, they certainly do. Few things are more enchanting to them than a fine garden, and bouquets on the center tables are positive necessities with every lady from Maine to the Rio Grande. In contrast to American ladies, Downing allows us how English women had no such finicky approach to gardening. If anyone wants to know how completely and intensely English women enter into the spirit of gardening, he has only to watch the wife of the most humble artisan who settles in any of our cities. She not only has a pot of flowers, her backyard is a perfect curiosity shop of botanical rarities. She's never done with training and watering and caring for them. And truly, they reward her well. For whoever saw such large geraniums, such fresh daisies, such ruddy roses. Hear, hear for the Brits. They did sort of invent gardening, didn't they? Downing then clinches his argument for turning American women into active gardeners. Exercise, fresh air, health. Are they not all almost synonymous? Nor will he brook argument from those who say, but Mr. Downing, think of the hot sun in this country and our complexions. His reply, yes, yes, we know it, but get up an hour earlier, fair reader, put on your broadest sunbonnet, your stoutest pair of gloves, and try the problem of health, enjoyment, and beauty before the sun gets too ardent. Great deal may be done in this way, and after a while, if your heart is in the right place for ruralities, you will find the occupation so fascinating that you will gradually find yourself able to enjoy keenly what was at first only a very irksome sort of duty. 100 years later, training her critic's eye on other nurserymen-turned-garden writers, we find Catherine White, longtime editor at The New Yorker, acting as a garden catalog reviewer in one of the articles she contributed to the magazine under the subhead, Onward and Upward in the Garden. Here she is poring over her seed and plant catalogs. For gardeners, winter is the season of lists and callow hopefulness. Hundreds of thousands of bewitched readers are poring over their catalogs, making lists for their seed and plant orders, and dreaming their dreams. It is the season, too, when the amateur gardener, like myself, marvels or grumbles at the achievements of the hybridizers and frets over the idiosyncrasies of the editors and writers who get up the catalogs. They are as individualistic, these editors and writers, as any Faulkner or Hemingway, and they can be just as frustrating or rewarding. They have an audience equal to the most popular novelists, and a handful of them are stylists of some note. Even the catalogs with which no one man can be associated seem to have personalities of their own. Digging into her subject, White was able to surmise that the sage of White Flower Farm in Litchfield, Connecticut, who signs his writings, Amos Pettingill, was using a pseudonym for effect. She later learned that his real name was William Harris, which is obviously devoid of colonial Yankee flavor. What she really appreciated about this individual were the nursery bulletins called White Flower Farm Notes. Here, Amos really lets himself go, is chatty, sassy, or lyrical as the mood dictates. And here he airs his latest enthusiasms and his pet grouches. Many other garden writers have a style that is familiar and chatty, so it is no surprise that they are often great letter writers as well. Naturally, they sometimes correspond with one another. Catherine White and Elizabeth Lawrence, who many consider to be the doyen of the Southern Garden, amassed a trove of correspondence. It began with a fan letter from Elizabeth to Catherine shortly after the first Onward and Upward article appeared in the New Yorker. Although the two women, one writing from Maine, the other from North Carolina, only met face-to-face once, the successes and failures they experienced in their respective gardens, the mutual esteem in which each held the other, and the sympathetic concern they felt for one another took them well beyond the bounds of garden talk. White was only one member of Lawrence's wide circle of correspondence, which included a range of plant enthusiasts from botanical authorities to the farm women who advertised their seeds and bulbs in the Mississippi Market Bulletin. Her correspondence with one of the latter, Mrs. Grady Stamps of Bogue Chitteau, Louisiana, extended over several years. Writing about one such exchange with Mrs. Stamps in her weekly column in the Charlotte Observer, Lawrence reported, "Mrs. Stamps said she would be glad to have seed of anything I have that is new, meaning new to her, so I looked around the garden to see what was going to seed and found fennel and Clematis texensis. Mrs. Stamps wrote me right back, 'I never did have the fennel, and the Clematis seed you sent are larger than any I've ever seen. I love to work with flowers, advertise, and get letters from people. As long as I can, I'll work with my flowers, but I'm about to get too disabled to work much in them like I used to, so I want bulbs and perennials that will stay there. I must stop now, or I won't have room to enclose some seed. I love to give as well as receive.'" Many of the writers that I encountered, from Gertrude Jekyll to Michael Pollan, hark back to their early memories of a childhood garden, a family garden, or their own precious plot in which they witness for the first time the miraculous transformation of seed into plant. Pollan tells us, "My first garden was a place no grown-up ever knew about, even though it was in the backyard of a quarter-acre suburban plot. Behind our house in Farmingdale, Long Island, stood a rough hedge of lilac and forsythia that had been planted to hide the neighbor's slat wood fence. My garden, which I shared with my sister and our friends, consisted of the strip of unplanted ground between the hedge and the fence. To a four-year-old, though, the space made by the vaulting branches of the forsythia is as grand as the inside of a cathedral, and there is room enough for a world between the lilac and the wall. Whenever I needed to be out of range of adult radar, I'd crawl beneath the forsythia's arches, squeeze between two lilac bushes, and find myself safe and alone in my own green room." What child does not relish taking possession of a leafy enclosure and making invisibility a kind of power? Pollan tells us of his self-defining moment as a gardener-to-be when one day when he discovered a stippled green football sitting in a tangle of vines and broad leaves and made the connection between the seed he had spit out and shoved in the ground a few months earlier and the watermelon he now beheld. Never mind that the watermelon crashed to the ground as he ran to show it to his mother. He philosophizes, "Memories of one kind or another play around the edges of every garden, giving them much of their resonance and savor. I've spent thousands of hours in the garden since that afternoon, and there is perhaps some sense in which all this time has been spent trying to recover the watermelon and the flush of pride that attended its discovery." As I commented earlier, throughout the book lurks a particular wily enemy. You know what we're getting to again now. It is that dreaded night marauder, the slug, the bane of every gardener. We saw Celia Thaxter rising at midnight and heaping salt on the collars she had placed around each of her tender young plants. salt being one surefire slug deterrent. Unlike pesticides, yet another theme for garden writers whose conscience has been pricked by Rachel Carson's early warning about their noxious effects, salt is not a systemic poison. Instead, tender young plants, as we have seen, must be carefully protected and not allowed to absorb the harsh salinity that acts as a toxic slug killer. Therefore, these ubiquitous garden invaders must be attacked every night. Bob Dash, the owner of Madu on Long Island, tells us how he sallies forth in the darkness to pick off the slimy miserables and drop them in jars of salted water. Apparently, it's worth the trouble. After a nocturnal raid such as this, he exults. The vegetable garden is returned to its flourishing condition. Salads are simple and uncomplicated matters. Leaves taken from the outer bouquets of the plants, a few eaten while picking, the flavor of cold wet dew on a morning lettuce leaf, which is better than coffee or grapefruit juice and toast and jam. Dahlias. Who would think that they would raise the emotional temperature of so many gardeners? William Robinson, who, as we know, did not mince words, employed the typical literary invective in censuring the gardener who would have the specimen dahlia banish the hollyhock and other simple old-fashioned flowers. Marjorie Fish generously titled one of her several garden books, We Made a Garden. She would never go as far as Elizabeth in Elizabeth's German Garden in calling her husband a man of wrath, but we soon discover their opposing natures as she gives us a picture of a martinet who wanted a host of dahlias marching in military precision while she was trying to turn the property around their old manor house in Somerset into a kind of garden that Gertrude Jekyll and William Robinson would have approved of. With admirable forbearance, she says, when we first started gardening, I was only allowed to watch, for future reference, the great ritual of planting dahlias. I think I was permitted to get barrow loads of manure and cans of water, but he would not trust me to do more. In after years, when he could not do the heavy jobs, I had to plant them, but he always stood by to see that I didn't cheat. First of all, Walter dug a large, deep hole. He never worried about treading on my plants or smothering them with the great piles of earth that were thrown up. So I had to be careful not to plant anything within a wide radius. A little fancy soil, I mean, for this good compost or a nice potting mixture, was sifted in all around the tuber and then some, but not all of the earth dug out was put back. Instead of a nice smooth finish, there had to be a saucer-like hollow to catch the moisture that would come from heaven or the watering can. It was no good for me to tell him that it looked as if the cat had been busy. It didn't matter what my bed looked like so long as each dahlia was given all the comfort humanly possible. When he had finished, I used to go around removing surplus earth that was heaped up all around each planting, but I never dared shovel it back into the hollows as I wanted to. Some things were sacred. Watering the dahlias was one of the things I was supposed to do and often shirked. If ever Walter saw me with a can in my hand giving refreshment to some little stranger or preparatory to sowing seeds, I know I should hear, "Are you going to water the dahlias? I am afraid I got in the habit of doing my watering when he wasn't around. I wouldn't have minded if a small amount of water would have sufficed. Nothing less than a whole canful had to be poured slowly down each horrible little hole, and the contents of one can would bring new life to quite a lot of my small treasures. In the end, Marjorie triumphed through tacit subversion and nature taking its course. She relates, "The problem has been solved for me because I was never very successful in keeping tubers through the winter. Unlike the cottagers whose favorite place for storing them is the spare bedroom, I have only outhouses and they are all cold and drafty places. Under the staging of a greenhouse is a good place, but I have no greenhouse. And however carefully I stored them, tucking them up in mountains of straw, the cold always managed to find them, and every season there were a few less until I was reduced to two very ordinary red ones, a double and a single, and these I leave in the ground. They come up year after year, and I'm quite glad to see them." Eleanor Perrigny, on the other hand, thinks dahlias are dandy. Her style is piquant, opinionated, intentionally contrarian, and refreshing. Hear her on the subject. "Looking at my dahlias one summer day, a friend whose taste runs to the small and impeccable said sadly, 'You do like big, conspicuous flowers, don't you?' She meant vulgar, and I am used to that. It hasn't escaped me that mine is the only wasp garden in town to contain dahlias, and not the discreet little singles either. Some are Renoir girls. Others are like spiky sea creatures. Water lilies are the spirals in a crystal paperweight. And they do shoot up to prodigious heights. But to me, they are sumptuous, not vulgar. And I love their colors, their willingness to bloom until frost kills them. And yes, their assertiveness. I do like big flowers when they are beautiful." If you are a garden writer, traveling is a great way to get ideas for both your garden and your books and articles. Edith Wharton's Italian Villas and Their Gardens, published in 1904, can be read both as a traveler's guide and as a source of landscape design inspiration. Her audience included the discriminating American tourists traveling through Italy and the Gilded Age owners of great estate gardens created in the Italianate style back home. Mark that Italian and Italianate are not the same thing. It is the difference between substance and style, between romance and replication. Or, as Wharton put it, "The traveler returning from Italy, with his eyes and imagination full of the ineffable Italian garden magic, knows vaguely that the enchantment exists, that he has been under its spell, and that it is more potent, more enduring, more intoxicating to every sense than the most elaborate and glowing effects of modern horticulture. But he may not have found the key to the mystery. Is it because the sky is bluer, because the vegetation is more luxuriant? Our midsummer skies are almost as deep, our foliage is as rich, and perhaps more varied. There are indeed not a few resemblances between North American summer climate and that of Italy in spring and autumn. Some of those who have fallen under the spell are inclined to ascribe the Italian garden magic to the effect of time. But wonder-working as this undoubtedly is, it leaves many beauties unaccounted for. To seek the answer, one must go deeper. The garden must be studied in relationship to the house, and both in relationship to the landscape. The Italian country house, especially in the center and south of Italy, was almost always built on a hillside, and one day the architect looked forth from the terrace of his villa and saw that, in his survey of the garden, the enclosing landscape was naturally included. The two form part of the same composition. An inveterate traveler, Paula Dietz, is more apt to tourists through the gardens of France, England, and Asia than those of Italy. But my favorite of her essays is the one she wrote about Beatrix Ferrand's garden close by her own summer place in Maine. Ferrand was an extraordinary garden designer and plants woman, as well as America's first important woman landscape architect. At the age of 82, she dismantled Reef Point, her wonderful three-acre garden in Bar Harbor, rather than allow it to fall into ruin after her death. From her close study of Foran's Reef Point bulletins, which she republished in book form in 1997, Paula is able to reconstruct the now-vanished garden on the page and give us an imaginary tour of it. Let's walk through it with her. Starting at the vine garden along the house, we follow in Foran's footsteps as she reveals for us we fall in Paula's footsteps as she reveals for us the garden as it existed in Foran's time. Passing beyond those rose gardens, we come to an area planted with rhododendrons and mountain laurels, following which we tour the kitchen garden with its espaliered fruit trees, the perennial borders and rock garden facing one another across the lawn, the mass of pink azaleas, the holly hedges, the collection of heathers, and at last the bog garden with its intriguing carnivorous pitcher plants. We learn that the remaining native spruces were part of an enclosed windbreak, and we can still see across the bay the pointed firs memorably described by Sarah Orne Jewett, terminating the view from the garden in a serrated horizon line. Summoning Celia Thaxter to her side, Dietz compares the seemingly casual abundance of Thaxter's Appledore Island garden with Reef Point, where Foran did what she loved most by creating a main garden of apparent simplicity, where families of plants laid out in drifts meshed with others in a studied asymmetry. I think you can see why I have given Writing the Garden, the subtitle, A Literary Conversation Across Two Centuries. Even when separated by distances of time or space, garden writers are inherent friends. If we should seek an overarching theme here, it is that of collegial comradeship among a non-exclusive circle that includes you, the reader, whether or not you are a gardener. Thank you.
So we have a couple of minutes for questions before we'll have book signing, so perhaps we could take three or four. Anyone?
Yes. You'll have to speak. I have a hearing issue. Speak louder, or do we have one of those things? No. Okay. Here, you must. The Paula will answer that question. Come.
Well, it was after the Bar Harbor fire. The city of Bar Harbor was very hesitant to give her a tax exemption, and she really wanted to make it like the Arnold Arboretum, to have a nonprofit botanic garden and school, really, as the time went on. And they just really decided they couldn't afford to take it off the tax rolls. And so she said, all right, then I'm going to end it, just like that. And, of course, as we know, that most of the plants were removed by Charles Savage, whose family owned the Astigou Inn, to the two gardens at the other side of the island, the Astigou Azalea Garden and the Thuya Garden. And so that's where her plants, and she would go with her chauffeur and watch them replanting her garden.
Thank you. I could never have answered that so well. Who else has a question they'd like to ask? No questions? We can talk outside then. Here, Harriet has a question.
Well, Nancy, I thought it would be so interesting if you would talk a little bit about how you began to collect books on gardening in your own collection of books.
Oh, my own collection of books. Okay. I am a native of San Antonio, Texas, and when I became a New Yorker, as my mother said, she sunk down her roots in that stony soil, and there she stayed. And this library was one of the important parts of my life as a young woman living in New York, and it was actually my second book, Frederick Law Olmsted's New York, or maybe it was before I even wrote the book, but I discovered a journey through Texas, and he wrote Journey in the Seaboard Slave States, Journey to Texas, and Journey in the Backcountry, and this was in the 1850s, it was before the Civil War. So antebellum historians find these books very interesting. He was not an abolitionist. He was part of the Free Soil movement. Anyway, the books were published, and lo and behold, there was one at the Strand bookstore that was Journey to Texas, and I could see in it San Antonio and the Texas Hill Country, and I thought, I just got to have this book, and it was $50. But I wrote out the check. And that was the first book that I ever collected. And then I went on to become, as I wrote my book, Landscape Design, A Cultural and Architectural History, I got that terrible disease, you know, collector's avarice. And then I began to collect some really wonderful rare books, some of which were in the exhibition last year at the Morgan Library. And so I was on this exhibition roll when Mark came up and Harriet and Jeanette Sanger and said, well, how about an exhibition on another kind of garden book, which is the book that writers write about gardening. And I had, by that time, collected several of those, and the reason the library's books are rare books is because the library is so old and they have aged on the shelves like good wine. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
I think there was a question back in the corner.
Well, sort of. What inspired you to put together this sort of compendium?
What inspired me to put together what? Oh, the compendium, it sort of put itself together. I mean, look, no book writes itself. Don't ever let anybody tell you that, and it doesn't. But what happened as I would read these books, I would realize that there were these common themes and that there were these personalities. But then as I started to sort them out, I thought, well, these fall in this category. Linda, you are a garden teacher, an instructor on the urban garden. She's writes exclusively for the New York Times, you know, about the urban garden. So when these columnists, columns are collected and put into books, those books were, you know, part of what I read, and it just looked like you were part of the conversation, Linda. So, anyway, that's why it's called a literary conversation over two centuries.
So, finally, Betsy Rogers will be available to sign. Copies are available outside if you'd like to purchase. And if you come back in the room, we'll set up a table for her here where she can rest her feet and get her pen ready. So, thank you all for coming.